mentioned that when I was on retreat, we took this Myers-Briggs type indicator. Remember that little clipping that I gave you on that the style that we adopt for prayer is going to be determined by our type, and that somebody who is going to be an extrovert is going to feel uncomfortable with an introvert's prayer style, and that we shouldn't feel guilty about it, and that most people who write on prayer are going to be the introverts and not the extroverts. And so that most of the books on prayer are going to be uncomfortable or are not going to be as comfortable for an extrovert as it is for an introvert. And this is true. I was making all sorts of little applications as we were talking about, for instance, what we were saying before, that people who want just answers are one kind of type, and the person who really likes the questions is another kind of type. So that I think that this type indicator can help us understand each other and ourselves, and that's why I decided that it would be a good thing, and I spoke to Kay and Jim about it at one point, and it's very inexpensive to use, so that it's a handy thing. And I think to sort of sense how it came to be is important. Isabel Briggs, the main person who worked on this, just died this last May at the age of 82. And she was brought up by her mother, more or less, educationally, at home. She went to school as a ninth grader, but her mother had her on sort of an honors reading program from, well, through her whole education up through college, to college. Ever so often, her mother would decide, well, we ought to see if she really knows what the kids in school are knowing, so she'd send her off to take some tests. And she'd be in school for a week and see whether she could hold her own with the rest of the class. And if she could, then her mother said, okay, then we continue on the way we're doing it. And this probably colored the fact that she went to Swarthmore College, and that's where she met her husband, but she was a political science major and then taught economics at Swarthmore, but really did her work in psychology and never really took any psychology. She was just a total amateur in it. And it probably was because of the way she was educated to begin with. Her mother became interested in personality types because the fellow that Isabel married was a lawyer and completely different from Isabel. And she thought to herself, there's no way these two are going to be able to get along. But they did. And she was trying to understand why. And so mother and daughter were looking at types of personalities in books that they were reading, biographies and novels. And they lined up four kinds of personality types. And they call them the meditative type, the spontaneous type, the executive type, and the social type. Then in 1923, they came across Jung's book on personality type. And of course, Jung doesn't use those terms, but their descriptions were identical. Isabel's are meditative type, spontaneous type, executive type, and social type. And see, Jung lines those up differently, and we'll be doing a little bit with that later. But in what they were, they were describing the same kinds of people. Isabel had two children. One, a son, is still living, and he's working with the Natural Resources Committee, looking at nuclear waste, what to do. That's what he's doing currently. Her daughter died several years ago after very minor surgery, and what she was working on was educational materials in reading and math, taking into consideration that the child who wants nothing but answers and everything sit and pat should have one style of reading and arithmetic, and the child who likes answers and questions and it wants to be spontaneous needs a different type of educational approach. So that was the kind of material one of her daughters was working on. During World War II, she became very aware that many people were taking jobs out of a sense of patriotism at which they were very unhappy. And so she thought there should be a way of matching up jobs with people so that they could enjoy the job that they're doing. And she went back to this notion of types. And her husband knew the head of the George Washington School of Medicine and allowed her to start giving tests to the medical students to decide what kind of types were there. And then it was a longitudinal study that went on for about 20 years, checked on the ones who were overachievers and underachievers, dropouts, and just to see what she did. And she did all this by hand. She did about 10,000 nursing students and collated all the information all by hand. And this was totally against her personality type because she didn't like picky little jobs like that, but because she was so interested in what she thought could really be a help to people, you know, it pulled her over, this picky little job. Finally, by 1960, Auburn University and the University of Michigan and the University of Florida began working with them in their psych departments and in their education departments. In 1962, the test itself came out. The one we have here is one that was redone in 77. And at this point, it's been translated into Japanese, it's in Europe, it's in the United States, and it's in Canada, so that it's a rather widespread instrument in just a very short time, even though she herself had been working on it for over 40, well, must be 60 years that she had been working on it. In 1975, in Florida, they began a center for the application of psychological types, so that it's kind of a big thing. What she herself was aiming at, or her motives behind this, was this notion of choosing a life's job and division of labor. How can we get people and jobs best matched so that the job can be done well, but so that the person can be best? It's also for her a tool in understanding communication and in helping teamwork. And she felt it was a way of gaining control over one's own life and increasing one's own excellence. I think one of the reasons why I particularly liked it is I like the idea of individual uniqueness. That's something, I don't know, maybe part of it comes from having lived in a convent where, you know, even the cuffs had to be 4 inches on every one of our habits, and, you know, everything was exactly the same, and the notion was everything in common and think the same thoughts, and I mean, that's kind of a caricature of what happened, but the notion was sameness, and there was something inside of me, I think, that, you know, was rebelling against that, and so I became more and more conscious of uniqueness, and I came up with my notion of thumbprint theology. You know, every person's thumbprint is different than, you know, we are different. And I, you know, really tried to point out uniqueness of people. And like when I was choosing Christmas gifts for our old sisters, when I was in charge of our infirmary, I got everybody a mug. And it took me hours and hours to find 40 mugs that were different. I mean, you know, to go to stores so that each person's mug was totally different, because I wanted to say, you are different from everybody else. And I know some people thought I was, you know, after all, what difference does it make if you've got everybody having the same cup? But for our coffee breaks, I wanted everybody to have, you know, a mug that was different. And so I think that by being aware of our types, we can be aware of our own uniqueness and appreciate our own uniqueness and appreciate the differences in other people. I can remember the time when, for the first time, I heard the second half of love your neighbor as yourself. It was always there, but I never heard it. And we cannot, you know, love our neighbor unless we love ourselves, and I don't think we can love ourselves unless we appreciate our own uniqueness, and we'll never be what God created us to be unless we are that unique person. And I think, you know, going through this type indicator just underlines the uniqueness and appreciation of uniqueness for everyone. This type indicator has been used in industry and business, and I can just, well, later on I'll show that to you. They're working on it in education. For instance, this people types and tiger stripes is done in an education department. And the notion is to recognize that children are going to be different types, and the kind of learning experience that's going to be the most effective for them has to be different. And it's called Tiger Stripes because it seems, although I think that it's not total, that a personality type cannot be changed. And the harm that comes in school or in a family when you're trying to change the, you know, the extroverted type of person into a more quiet one, or make the introvert into an extrovert. I don't know if there's any research that's been done on what happens when you make a left-handed person right-handed. Yeah, you know, I don't know how much what they're, but I think there's a certain kind of comparison here. But the notion that many people who are using the notion of type are saying you really can't change it. And if you're going to develop as a person, and Jung's notion of individuation is you develop your dominant type. Doesn't mean that you let your shadow or your auxiliary types be weak, but you cannot substitute one for the other. You develop your strong one, and at the time that that's strong, then you have your own, I suppose, Erikson's notion of identity, and then you can develop, you know, the other ones. So that's Tiger Stripes. It's being used in marriage counseling, and it's being used in parental counseling to help parents understand their children that maybe when parents are saying something, the youngster really can't hear it at all. And I think, you know, what we were talking about just before in the previous hour, that, you know, Jim Fish and the group simply were not talking with each other at all. And that can happen when we recognize that different personality types can't really hear exactly the same thing that someone else hears. And we have to be aware of that. And so that people aren't just not wanting to hear, but it actually seems to be, I don't know if you could call it mechanical, but something that's really within the person. And so we just shouldn't say, well, he's stubborn, he doesn't want to, you know, that we need to make that kind of an allowance. I have here something that I'd like us to go through because it's easier if we have it in our hand than if I just tried. And I thought that for most of you, you probably might somewhere along the line want to be doing something more with this. And if you reread it and want to go over it, it's nicer to have it in your hand. I typed a few things from an essay of Isabel's called Type and Teamwork. And I think what I'd like us to do is read the first two paragraphs, and then what are the things or the applications we could make, or what are the implications of these first two paragraphs for us? Thank you. something that I could say is, I came across this when I made retreat at Pecos. I was there for a month, and the whole community, anybody who enters the community is, and they really work with this. Morton Kelsey's wife is the one who brought it to them, this type indicator. And I was thinking, I'm glad you're here, John, it just might not be a bad thing for, you know, staff to take and be aware of and work with. And I know that one day there were a group of us working at something, and two of the members of the community at Pecos were just not seeing eye to eye. And a third one all of a sudden realized that there was a little bit of friction arising. And they say, don't you two realize that he is an ENTP and this one is this? And the two of them laughed. And all of a sudden, the third one explained to the one and explained to the other one. They understood, and everything went on very nicely. And I saw that several times, you know, in operation. It became a tool that they used for communication. And when they forgot, you know, somebody would bring it in, and all of a sudden, then you know, things went on better. So I think that there are real values to recognizing this, and particularly between husbands and wives and with their children, that there, from research that's been done on junior high youngsters, and I think that was, there were like three or four studies that I've read about, where unless the seventh or eighth grader is very, very immature, all four areas are valid. There is one in the immature junior high school that seems that is really not a true indication. In other words, I'm saying that by the time people are in junior high, their personality type is set enough that this particular instrument seems to be valid to use. Okay, what are some of the implications that you can see from this? Or uses, maybe, would be another way of looking at it.
I guess as a, from a practical standpoint, if you were an employer and you had a certain type of job, it might take a certain type of person, and if you could judge somehow what that type was, you might alleviate potential problems.
And that's exactly the way industry is using this. You've got a supervisor who's this type and really cannot communicate with these types, and therefore there's no sense in putting that person in her office. They've just worked out. This happens to be an industry that Isabel was working with, and this is their administrative team, their management team. And she is showing here that there are three people who have three of the four types in common. And there are one, two, three, four people here who have only one type in common. And I think there are two people with this cross line that have no type in common. And so that the chances of those two seeing eye to eye are rather zero. The team looking at what they are recognizes when someone is asking a question or questioning or not understanding that someone else on the team has to explain this, because there's someone else there that can relate to that person. And it becomes, you know, a useful thing.
That raises a question. In the way she uses it, a single person is one type. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
So when you said the team, you meant a group of people. It isn't as though a manager is a mixture of two types that she's okay.
No. You have four categories. There end up being 16 what you might call pure types, and then 32 what would be mixed types, because it could be, like for instance for myself, my judging and perception come out exactly even. Now, I don't think I really operate that way, but on the test I came out that way. And so that there are these mixed types, so that if you are come out, you know, completely even on a type, that then they put a little X for that, the place where you're both, there's, you don't seem to have a preference. If we take a look at the rest of that, what I did is I typed out on the back, on page 2, what the 4 major types, how they relate to each other. The opposite of a sensing type is the intuitive. And so that what one has to bring to the other, you can see they're crossed back and forth there.
Give me your idea of sensing.
Okay, sensing means anything that has to do with the senses. I can weigh it, I can touch it, it's the empirical, that kind of person. And the intuitive is the person who is operating with ideas.
Now on page 3 I see we have 6 types instead of 4 types.
You're going to find 8.
8?
Because there are 2 on the bottom.
Extroverts and introverts.
Yeah, so that we... the way you explain introvert and extrovert, the extrovert's world is outside of him. The introvert's world is within. And then how we deal with our world is either in a closed way, in other words, we want the answers, or it's sort of open-ended. And that's the judging and the perceptive.
Yeah,
it's perceptive. I mistyped and I didn't get through the, I noticed afterwards that where I made errors and used the fluid, I didn't cut through. And so that all of us are either judging or perceptive, and it just depends on how we deal with our world. And then the other 4, the 4 that we have on that second page there, are the way we function, either as an introvert or an extrovert, or as judging and perceptive of our world. This is the way we see and the way we make a judgment.
I may be, again, exposing my dislike of categories and labels, but I'm familiar with these 4 ways of dividing up types from Jung's work. I think, as a parent, something else that I have found needs to come into play is we have observed with our children anyway, and other children we know, that growth and development seems to follow a pattern of equilibrium, and then it breaks up into total disequilibrium, and then you arrive at a new equilibrium as a person develops their potentials. I think it's very important to keep in mind that this continues to happen throughout adulthood. And although we may think we have ourselves all figured out, all of a sudden we hit age 35 or 40 and it all breaks up again. And we have to reevaluate. The popular term now, of course, especially for men, is the midlife crisis. But we all have our crises all along the way from birth. And although I think it's probably accurate that you could categorize a person maybe in a general way, I think it's very difficult to get too specific, because often you'll see an adult who has thrown, men especially, they've thrown themselves into the pursuit of a career. This is getting more common for women as it's being encouraged. Used to be women got through college and got married, or, you know, the lesser choice was to pursue a career. Now that has changed drastically. But often men, they hit age 40 and they say, there's a feeling side to me too, and I would like to pursue that. It's just not very cut and dry.
Well, Jung says that until age 40, there's no possibility for actual individuation. That a person just hasn't matured enough yet until about that age.
But individuation occurs all along the way.
Right, right. But to really come to, well, I don't know.
Well, my mother's 78, and she doesn't think she's completely individuated yet. She's still busy trying to find a new side and a new twist to things.
No, I agree. I mean, I think that's obvious that we continually grow, and there's no... And see, here, they talk always about preference. When I'm looking at a situation, my makeup allows me, or I prefer to make my judgment, or I prefer to see a certain way because of my makeup. It doesn't mean I don't use both, but there is one that I develop more just because that's the way I made. And it seems that way that I made is the tiger stripe, you know, that there isn't that much that can be done about changing it. You can develop the other side.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems that people who have not developed their dominance end up being ineffective. So that if they are, for instance, constantly balancing all of them, sort of not finding what their dominant is, they don't become efficient. They don't become effective people. And even in their work, that seems to be what's happening. I'm talking as if I know something, and I really don't. I just found it, I thought, very valuable. And my aim today was just to show what the possibilities were for this. And in the kit came 5 tests and 25 questions, what do you call them, tests itself, the answer sheets. And I was thinking that, you know, like 3 of you would take a test booklet, take somewhere between 45 minutes and an hour, and if I get these between now and Thursday, 6 o'clock, the answer sheets, then on Friday, what we would do is there is a profile, and I would, you know, score them for you, and then we would actually get into what the different types are. Today was more a notion of why these types could be valuable and how each type needs the other type and how each group needs all types if it's going to function well. That was the purpose of, you know, the class today, was just to, you know, kind of alert us to that kind of thing. And I thought it would be better if we didn't define the type too strictly. See, if you notice, I've just got one needs the other. We're not really describing it too much because there's, I think maybe a kind of a little built-in prejudice in us, and we filter the way we want to filter sometimes. And I thought it would be easier if we didn't define them closely at all, so that as you ask these questions, in case you want to be intuitive or you want to be feeling and you don't want to be a thinker, you think, well, I wonder now, how would I answer this question? I mean, you know, whether we know it or not, we do that kind of thing. So I didn't want to define our terms too closely at all today. At the bottom of page 2 and then on to page 3, we have effects of PF, each preference in our work situation. And so that, you know, if you happen to be a personnel manager, or if you happen to be the way many of us here are, looking at what kind of a work situation we want later, if you're the kind of a person who dislikes answering a telephone, then that's not the kind of situation you want to put yourself into. If you don't mind it, in fact, maybe even like it, well, and so that we've got listed there what seem to be the kinds of situations that the person thrives in best. And they're therefore, and you can see why in certain situations you need this person and you need that person and they have to work together. They have to work together.
You've got a bunch of people here who chose to be in an isolated place where they can't even answer telephone. I think that's going to skew the results a little.
Yeah. But my intuitive is so high that my sensing came out one. And all my other scores were on intuitive. And when I was typing this up, and it says sensing type, seldom makes errors of fact. And I'm the bookkeeper here. Tends to be good at precise work. And you know, I can look at the page and add, and I can't find my error. It tells me why. I mean, I knew that before I did that, but it's...
Is this one take?
But it really, it can kind of, I know for myself, just with the bookkeeping, I can get sort of frustrated being, you know, because I make such a stupid mistake. And then I think, well, you know, how dumb can you be? And then I think to myself, well, it's not that you're dumb, you're just developing your shadow side and learn to be more precise. And I think, you know, that helps a person be patient with himself.
Did the group get into Fox enough that you did some discussion? Or Rich Kemmerer, right side, left side, yin,
mm-hmm,
yang.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's not unrelated to that.
Yeah. And see, and I think that's related, the whole thing is also related to sun spirit. You know, the masculine and feminine. I think that's all related in there too.
Is the way this lines up, are you saying that if you're intuitive, then your shadow side is necessarily sensing, or
right, it is.
Okay.
They're opposites
of
each other.
So an intuitive person does not have a judging shadow side.
Oh no, the intuitive person could be a judging type. Are you crisscrossing this way?
Yeah,
you pair across. You are either one or the other across. But
you're not a whole column.
You're not a column. You can be either side for the other three.
Okay. So the left side, okay.
Across each other out. And the one that, where you're dominant, like for instance, in my intuitive, my sensing is my shadow, and the other two are my auxiliary. Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by auxiliary? Maybe you explained. You said one is...
No, I haven't done any explaining, and I thought I would do that on Friday. But the auxiliaries, see, what you end up with out of these is you're either an extrovert or an introvert. Then you are, and then they do those, you're an E or an I. Then you are, let's say, for instance, I happen to be an extrovert. My extroversion is 2-to-1 to introversion. My sensing is 1-to-40 to intuitive. So I am a sensing. My feeling is 3-to-1 against thinking. And my JP, my judging perceptive, came out exactly half. I'm an X there. I mean, I'm either one. Although I know that by the way I live, I'm much more perceptive than I'm judging. I mean, I don't need to have answers. I mean, I can live with the questions. And I mean, there are a lot of things in judging that for myself isn't. But because my intuitive is so strong, my sensing is my shadow. And I know that. I mean, reading this just told me what I already knew. It was kind of fun. And it helped me understand some of the things that have bothered me about myself. Well, like for instance, making errors of fact, not remembering things that I really should have remembered. But you know, if that's not really, if the type really is a tiger stripe, then that's something I shouldn't fight, you know, really hard about, accept it, and then, you know, try to develop it, but I don't have to be panicky about it, you know, or feel guilty that I'm just closing off something that I shouldn't be. And I think it's just made me a little bit easier to live with myself.
I think what was be helpful for me. I understand that you don't want to go too much farther if people are going to take the test. I agree. Mm-hmm. I also sense that you yourself have not pushed it to a place where at least I would be uncomfortable as final answers. And in other words, what would be helpful for me is like illustrations to where this was a helpful thing. It's one way in which you can look. It's not the final answer in which you start pegging people, but you named one illustration. Most of or many books about prayer are written by, so if you're not that type of person, that book can become more helpful with that knowledge. Or there might be some other books that would be more helpful. Or in other words, can you give a couple other illustrations as to how on that retreat some things opened up beyond your self-understanding into the matter of prayer, the matter of living in community, the matter of scripture reading, the matter, I don't know. Is that...
I'm hearing what you're, I mean, I know what you're asking. I'm not sure I can answer that, though. I think that for myself, it was just new to me. And as I said, I just thought it could be valuable for all of us, and all I can do is, you know, put it to us and then let us work from there. It would have been nice if it had been earlier. I think that, for instance, it has explained to me why some people I'm attracted to more and why I am not to others. And that has nothing to do with their moral qualities. In other words, they're not a better person. And I think sometimes in the past, when I've had kind of a negative feeling towards someone, I have wondered, you know, whether it was the vibing of the Lord between us that was the problem. And, you know, where was I at fault or where was the person at fault? And I look at it differently than I'm looking now. Now when somebody is very matter-of-fact and wants, you know, then I think, well, that's the kind of person they are. And I'm not comfortable with all those facts, and being that that's the only way to look at it, because I think there's another way, and we'll let them be that way. And they're not going to be able to look at it the way I do. So I think it's given me a kind of tolerance and an awareness that we use all of these to a degree. If we don't use all of them, then we're in trouble. But we have a preference, and they always use the term preference, and there is nothing cut and dried about this. I mean, there's a lot of leeway, and we do develop, and the more developed person is going to develop all of them to a degree. But you never, from what I've been reading, you never let go of your dominant. I mean, you don't try to, you know, like for instance, it would seem from my reading that if I would try to be a sensing type and just try to quit being an intuitive type, that what I would end up doing is getting into trouble. You know, that psychologically I upset an equilibrium within myself if I really try to, you know, completely switch types. That I think it's good for me to be a bookkeeper right now. And I knew that when I offered that, that's one way of becoming aware of and, developing it. I think that, for instance, one of the ways it's helped me is because of the kind of person I am, playing is hard. I don't play well, and that's something that's been really bothering me. But I'm not a sensing type, and the sensing type plays well. The intuitive type doesn't play well. And so even though it's, I think, a weakness in me, it's something I'm going to have to live with. I'm not going to enjoy playing the way other people can enjoy playing. And so, you know, let them play, and don't feel bad that you're not playing. I don't know whether I picked that up here or maybe that's something that's going to come on Friday. But they'll talk about, I think it's the sensing person though who...
A lot of games you need to keep track of essential details. That's a sensing person. To problem solve and face difficulties. Well, there's different kinds of games, but at least competitive games. I think intuitive people probably don't. Card games, memory games, Boggle, or things that go on at Holden. You see the type of people that like that and the type that don't like that. That's not the only kind of games.
Yeah.
Friends Journal has catalogs for non-competitive games, and I think intuitive people would probably enjoy some of those more than what are now called the games in our society. Is that what you mean?
See, the sensing person would like to do things with their hands and you know, with their senses, whereas the intuitive person is going to be dealing more with ideas and values and that kind of thing. And so that I think that that's what makes the difference. I think that that's a list that maybe will come up on Friday. Mm-hmm. I know I've read it somewhere, and I thought to myself, well, you know, now that's kind of interesting, that it's really more my type rather than my own home background, which it was, I think of us as a kind of peasant family. Actually, my dad had a master's in mechanical engineering, and that's what he worked at and was when metallurgy and electrical engineering and things, and I always was in a city. But I am a peasant, you know, come our family background is a peasant family, and it's work. And then when we got into the community, it was a work ethic. And play was a very small part of our life, and so all my life I've never played. Mm-hmm. And as I've looked at it, when I did play, like for instance, I played basketball, and we were city champions for 3 years. And the 6 years I played, I mean, I played hard at it, but I think I worked at it more than I played. You know, there wasn't the kind of abandon. Mm-hmm. And I have a hunch that comes more from type than from, I mean, some of it will come from my background, too. Mm-hmm. I agree to that. But there's something, I mean, there are nuns that I lived with who came out of the same kind of backgrounds, who played. Mm-hmm. And they were the people that I enjoyed being with, but somehow I never quite, mm-hmm. you know, I enjoy the person who's got a humor. The people around here who play, I really enjoy being around. But somehow I don't quite fit.
Gordon Dahl has a book on leisure and play. And how does he characterize the United States? We work at our play, and we worship our work, and we play at our worship.
Yeah. It should be in a plaque someplace.
Well, and I think, you know, I purposely, because of being aware of this, when the books on play, you know, Theology of Play, Hugo Rahner's, there are about six or eight theologies of play now in books. I purposely read them because I thought, well, maybe I'm going to learn something, you know, because I was very aware of this in myself. But I think it comes from a type. Chris?
When I think of types, I think, where do they come from? Where do we just develop them in response to another type, maybe a parental type?
No, it seems to be inborn, a tiger stripe. And so that parents, let's say if you have two extrovert parents, they can have an introvert child and they won't understand that child. And that child will be an unhappy child because it can never measure up to the activity of the parents. And like I have a niece and a nephew, and my niece is very definitely introvert. She was 3 years old. She could sit with 88 piano pieces upside down, sing for herself for an hour and a half, go through page, sometimes up and down. She had learned them all. And sit there for an hour and a half singing to herself at three. Her little brother at three would have died in an hour and a half by himself. He's always with people. Charming child. I mean, both of them are charming. But Anita, who is now seven, has to have time by herself. And when I was down there this summer, all of a sudden I looked out the window, and here she was wrapped around the clothesline pole, sitting at the top of it. And I looked out there, and I said to Becky, I said, what in the world is Anita doing on the clothesline? And she said, that's her way of getting away from Anil. He doesn't know how to get up the pole. And he'll come home, you know, come into the house and say, Mom, tell Anita to come down. And in fact, he did that while I was there. And Becky will say to Anil, honey, you know she needs time alone. Let her be. Don't bother her. Let her stay there. So that it seems, you know, that within us, it's born. And so to try and change it is, you know, not, although, for instance, like in our country, particularly for a male, to be masculine and feeling, I mean, to be introvert and feeling, is just not the acceptable image of a man. You know, and so, or even take, you know, the extrovert sensing woman is kind of not the picture. And so that, and in our schools, most of the people who go into teaching are extroverts, and they don't know how to deal with the introverted child. You know, maybe something I was going to, I left, that it might be interesting, they're saying here what the different child needs. For instance, a judging child needs structure and predictability. It needs mileposts for completions. It needs a system of accountability. But the perceptive child needs variety, novelty, change. It needs autonomy and a possibility for choice. It needs to be spontaneous, freewheeling, and to be able to follow their curiosity. Now, if you've got those two kinds of children in a classroom and you're trying to do exactly the same thing, the thinking child wants order. It needs to achieve. It needs to have a sense of mastery. It needs to persist, prevail, to endure. The feeling child needs approval and personal support rather than a sense of achievement. The feeling child needs to be needed, needs to be helpful, and needs friends. And so that the thinking person doesn't really care that much what other people think about them, and the feeling person is going to just completely fall apart if it doesn't have personal support. And you can see the teacher who is a thinking person rather than a feeling person simply is not going to be aware of the need of the child who needs the personal support. And the teacher who, for instance, might be a feeling person might not be aware that the thinking child really has to have a sense of order, that spontaneity is going to really make them uneasy. And those of you who have taught, you've known, you know, the youngster that'll thrive if you really put him into a straitjacket. And another child just seems to freeze up in that situation. And we just have not in school made those kinds of provisions. And I think just from my 25 years in the classroom, if I had known what I'm just learning now, and I really want to learn more about, I think I could have been a much better teacher. And I think I could have made, you know, youngsters much more comfortable. And I think I could have helped a lot of parents understand their youngsters when they'd say, I just can't understand. And they can't, you know, if they had sensed that, you know, they felt that they were, what, morally responsible to understand, and we are, and yet we can understand by understanding these types that certain feelings are just not going to be there. You know, I mean, that there's going to be an insight we aren't going to have, that the next person is going to have, and that's why we need the other person. And sort of trust that. Now, I don't know. There are 25 score sheets, and I thought those of you who want to take one can take it, then you have it. And then we would pass out, I had five. We'd pass these out, and like three of you would claim that you're going to use one, and then whoever the third one using it can give it back. So you make it out for yourselves how you want to use these, and then there are these. The notion on Wednesday was I would do theology of symbol, and then on Friday I can give you back these and your profiles, and then we can really try and define the types and work with that. That was my notion for the week. I leave these here. Any other things that somebody wants to say? Mark?
I really liked Rich Kammer when he was here, and I really liked his left brain, right brain type of thing. I think that I think with both sides of my brains, one at a different time, and it was neat, though, to go through that, because I think there are a lot of people, and myself included, that think a lot with their left side of the brain, and they need to experience more right brain type of thinking. And to me, I could look at this and almost think, well, a sensing type, there's a left brain person. An intuitive type is a right brain person.
And I have a hunch that there's a relationship in that.
And what and kind of some of the things you're saying, I guess I see it's a danger instead of saying, okay, since your left brain type will give you left brain things to do and your right brain type will give you right brain things to do. Whereas Rich Kammer was saying, you know, both are important. And so I think if I were a teacher and I said, you know, he's a sensing type, well, then I'm not just going to give him sensing types of things, but realize that and help him try to understand what it's like to be intuitive or something. And I can see a danger in splitting these things up.
No, I think you're right. And I think there is no experience that we can't profit from if we, you know, have an open mind. I know my mom and dad used to say, just never close your mind to anything because someday you're going to be happy that you noticed it. You know? And really, I mean, you know, some funny, odd, extraneous thing that a person's done or experienced, you know, holds you in good stead years later, even though at the time it seemed totally meaningless or, you know, kind of a pointless thing. But I think, you know, the more balanced we can be, and Jung would say that, you know, anybody who's doing with this, that you want to develop your auxiliaries, but that you need to be aware. For instance, those first pages where they were saying, you can understand like on a planning team where somebody who really wanted logical facts and plans and the other person was really interested, well, how is this going to really work for people? That the two of them would really have a hard time talking to each other unless they realized that this is the way, you know, this person really, that's their preferred way, and preferred, it sounds almost like, you know, I make the choice, but it's their mechanism is this. And my mechanism is this, and both of us have something to contribute, and within ourselves we have something to contribute. You know, I think it's just like the balancing of the masculine and the feminine within oneself. I mean, we are preferred, I mean, by preference we are one, the same way by preference we're here. I mean, we have no choice in the matter from what I can gather. And we don't have much choice whether we're masculine or feminine, but we can do something about developing, you know, both. Any other comment somebody wants to make here? Okay, here we are.